Welcome to the Mindful Dietitian interview series. I'm Fiona Sutherland, dietitian from Melbourne, Australia, and director of the Mindful Dietitian. Please join me as I interview dietitians from all over the world who are experts in health at every size, the non-diet approach, and mindfulness-based practice. These are a collection of interviews by a dietitian for dietitians and nutritionists so that we can build a strong community of wonderful professionals who share an inclusive vision of well-being for everybody. In everybody. Thanks so much for joining me. Hello, and welcome back to this next episode of the Mindful Dietitian interview series. Recently, it was so wonderful to sit down with our fellow dietitian, Dana Sturtevant, who's from Portland, Oregon. You may best know Dana as one half, so to speak, of Be Nourished, a revolutionary business helping people heal body dissatisfaction and reclaiming body trust, along with her business partner, Hilary Canavy. Hilary and Dana do incredible things together, such as training and certification for health providers, e-courses, and professional supervision. But alongside her partnership with Hilary, Dana is just simply incredible in her own right. She's not only a dietitian specializing in health at every size and intuitive eating, but she's also a yoga teacher and a member of the International Motivational Interviewing Network of Trainers, otherwise known as MINT. So Dana comes with a plethora of talents and skills and is obviously a real specialist when it comes to aspects of work, including mindfulness and self-compassion. Dana has facilitated more than 300 workshops throughout the US for health providers looking to enhance their skills in behavior change counseling. So if you're a dietitian looking for MI training in the US, I cannot recommend Dana highly enough. And I did see that she's running a course at Kripalu, which is a beautiful yoga retreat center on the East Coast. And that's where I met Dana and Hilary last year, which was such a great privilege. So Dana is also well known for being able to recite poetry off the top of her head. And luckily for us, we're able to hear her in action here. I just love hearing Dana recite poetry. She just does it off the top of her head. It's really quite an incredible talent. I've personally got the most enormous amount of respect and admiration for the work that Dana does and her work alongside Hilary. They are true game changers, and Dana is what I would describe as an authentic leader in our field. You can find out more about Dana and Dana and Hilary's work at www.benourished.org, and you can hear and see more about their provider training, certification, or e-courses through their newsletter. I hope you really enjoy this interview. See you soon. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are in the world. Today, I have the enormous pleasure of sitting down with the incredible Dana Sturtevant from Be Nourished in Portland, Oregon. So, good morning, and your good evening, Dana.
Hi, good evening. Yes, it's about 3:20 here.
Yeah, time for afternoon sodas, I suppose, and morning coffees for me. Dana, it's such an enormous pleasure to sit down with you. And I know that, you know, when we connected last year, we were musing about the incredible parallels between the journey of yourself and Hilary, and then myself and Sarah in Australia with Body Positive Australia. And I haven't had a great opportunity to sit down with you like this and understand a little bit more about your path to where you are today. And you and Hilary are just doing such incredible stuff. I've just got all the kudos and all the love and all the hugs, and we're all so grateful. Do you want to start us off, or do you mind starting us off telling us a little bit about your dietetic career?
Yeah. So I've been in practice about 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. And when I moved to Oregon in 1999, I got a job in research, and it was one of my first jobs out of school. And in the research world, I was working with participants in clinical trials, helping them make lifestyle changes to improve their health. And some of the studies that I worked on had a focus on weight and weight loss, and more specifically weight loss maintenance. And it was also at this research center job where I was exposed to motivational interviewing. And that's one of the things that I do in my business is train other healthcare providers in motivational interviewing. But that alone, in terms of that research position, to be extensively trained in a counseling style that helps me have better conversations with people about their behaviors and healing, it was critical to my career. So I'm very grateful for my time there. In particularly around that motivational interviewing training. I like to say that, you know, at least when I was trained, you know, most dietitians are trained to educate. And like most healthcare providers, we're trained to believe that knowledge is what changes behavior, but there is not a high correlation between what people know and what they do. Mm-hmm. And so motivational interviewing really gave me the counseling skills that I think are really necessary to be able to talk to people about change and about their health and about the ambivalence they feel when they're considering something different, when they're considering breaking up with diet culture and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So that was part of my journey in that job, or part of my work in that job was using motivational interviewing. And, you know, that it was in that work as a dietitian, I was called a health research interventionist was my term.
Ooh,
my
fancy.
Yeah, interventionist is kind of a scary term.
It is. I can visualize you in some kind of like big iron suit, you know, I am intervening.
Exactly. You must listen to me. No, it wasn't. That's what the term sounds like, right?
I know, scary.
Yeah. And I, you know, in that research job, I worked with I did both group facilitation and I did individual counseling sessions with the participants in the clinical trials. And the diet that we were working with, it was the DASH diet, dietary approaches to stopping hypertension. And a lot of the outcomes were focused on lowering blood pressure and reducing risk of heart disease. But of course, they also had a recommendation to lose a certain amount of weight during the studies. And so we used a 6-month intervention that the research center had been using for probably about 15 or so years before I came into the research center, because, you know, from their perspective, the intervention worked, people changed their behaviors, and they lost weight. Just like most things, the participants' weight was down at 6 months. So the intervention, the investigators I worked with said, you know, the intervention works. Well, you know, when we looked at the 2-year outcome data, we know where it was, right? Yeah. We know that the participants did not keep their weight off, that their weight was often back where it was at the start of the study, and oftentimes it was higher. And of course, the investigators did not believe the intervention was the problem. Yeah. They thought, you know, that just like people do, people blame themselves for failing, and I'm putting that in quotes, and for failing the diet, for having a hard time sustaining these unsustainable behaviors. And the investigators were were basically designing interventions in terms of how to help people maintain the weight they've lost. Mm. And by following them more consistently and doing phone calls and groups and some e-interventions. It was quite a while ago before e-courses and online interventions were a thing. And so they were testing some online e-based interventions as well. Mm. And, you know, I worked there for 7 or 8 years with this 6 month program and started to feel unethical. I started to wonder why we were talking about weight with people and why we were weighing them. And I thought, well, if we're healthcare providers and we want to help people improve their health, why don't we just focus on health behaviors and, you know, trust the body to sort out the weight. People do benefit from health behaviors regardless of what they weigh. And so this was my early thinking, like, why do we even make weight seems to be a problem in here? Like, making it about weight seems to be a problem. But of course, you know, nobody in the research that I, in terms of the staff and investigators that worked on the research study, you know, none of us thought we were promoting dieting, because we were all aware that dieting didn't work. We all truly believe that we were promoting healthy lifestyle change. But we were, you know, we were weighing people daily. Well, we were encouraging people to weigh daily, and we were weighing them once a week when they came in for groups. We recommended that they keep food records. And track their calories. We recommended that they exercise at a certain amount of minutes per week. There was a fruit and vegetable guideline, you know, all of these different guidelines. And, you know, now I know, you know, many years later, that we were promoting dieting. We could call it whatever we want. You know, when you look at the qualities of a dieting mind, people in that program were dieting, and they also, many of them had a pretty significant dieting history. So they came in with probably not meeting criteria for eating disorders. I think we would have screen them out with that, but you know, they probably had some level of disordered eating.
Yeah. What do you think it is about for researchers? Why were they holding on so tightly, do you think, to weight, even though there were some, especially in the early days, you described some really nice, you know, supportive lifestyle, quote unquote, interventions. But then it felt, as you were talking, it felt like they were focusing more and more and more on weight, and I'm curious to know what your thoughts are as to why they couldn't let that go despite the outcomes and despite what you were seeing. What was it that kept that front and center, do you think?
I think part is the belief that people, you know, in bunny ears need to lose weight to be healthy. I think they are products of living in a world filled with weight bias. So I think there was some bias just in that. Although I will say that the weight loss they were recommending and what most people wanted to lose were really different, you know, from in terms of dropping blood pressure, you know, they were recommending, you know, 5 to 10% of body weight, you know, 10 to 15 pounds for many people. Well, you know, most of the participants in the study didn't, you know, wanted to lose way more weight than that. Mm-hmm. But I think too, just coming from that, you know, that standard supposed evidence-based guideline for blood pressure is to have this recommendation for weight. So I think part of it was that. I think, you know, when you've developed a 6 month program and invested a lot of time and money and energy in your career, to walk away from that and say this is wrong and this is doing harm is a really hard thing. Mm-hmm. And I also think in the world of weight that there's this whole community of people who want to be the one to crack the code.
Oh, yes.
You know, we're going to be the ones to crack the code and fix these people. And even, you know, a couple years ago, I ran into one of the investigators, and he didn't know what I was doing in my private practice. And I was talking to him, and he said, oh, yeah, we've got some good ideas. We're going to put Bluetooth devices in people's scales, and then when they weigh, we're going to get the information sent to the center. Yeah, exactly. And you can imagine what was in my mind, like, I was in my mind going, you have no idea what I'm doing right now. I am horrified right now, but you have no idea that I might be horrified.
Oh, so, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh my
Good
goodness.
times. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a big part of it is people have based, spent their entire careers on a topic, and for them to admit that they're wrong.
There's a lot at stake, isn't there, really?
There's a lot at stake. Yeah, exactly.
And in the meantime, people are being harmed.
Yeah.
Not only people are being harmed, but very vulnerable people are not being helped. Which is, it's not one and the same. It's that it is different. But harm and not helping is in the same pool. It's in the same muck of this over focus on weight and numbers. And unfortunately, I think a lot of that paradigm, it trains people. It trains people, individuals, to feel like that is the focus, and it's all about numbers and getting the numbers down specifically. And so people go through their years feeling like that's the thing that they need to control. So when they hear, something about body trust or health at every size or intuitive eating, non-diet approach, all that kind of stuff, it no wonder people are like, what? What? Of course it feels different.
Yeah, it's a really big paradigm shift, and I think well, from a research perspective, I remember speaking up in the group, and they thought nobody would ever participate in something if we didn't make it about weight. I remember in one meeting, somebody said, well, people wouldn't participate in something like that, which was interesting given what my practice and business is all about. All these years later,
That's
yeah,
right.
we
In
know.
your face, by the way, in your face.
Yeah,
There we go. So
but I think
you moved on from there, did you?
I did. I so seven. I was there 7 or 8 years, and really just started to feel unethical, and was as a yoga teacher, was interested, and a yoga practitioner. I was really interested in incorporating the mindfulness and self-acceptance practices of yoga with food and body image and weight. Because one of the other things I saw in the study was that it didn't seem to matter how much weight people lost. Most people had this attitude that it wasn't enough and they still didn't like the size or shape of their body. And so, it seems almost like a cat chasing its tail, where it was never enough, it was never good enough. There was always still something that people wanted to change. And so I, through my disillusionment, thought, there's something more we could be doing here. And I also had, after working with people and seeing how life, real life, messy life, authentic life gets in the way of people being able to do the kinds of things that healthcare providers ask them to do in the name of weight loss. And I really didn't want to just slap band-aids on things. I really felt like that's what we were doing in research, is just slapping band-aids and not really going to the root. And so I knew I wanted to partner with a therapist, and I ended up going. Coming across an email where somebody was looking for a dietitian to join a clinic, and that's where I met Hillary. Hillary was the therapist that was brought into this clinic, and this clinic wanted to have a more holistic approach to weight. And when I look back that long ago, I'm like, yeah, we really didn't get it quite then either. But we were certainly doing something a little more alternative, but certainly it was not what we were doing today. But that's where I met Hillary Knabe, who's my business partner. She's a licensed professional counselor, and we started to facilitate groups for women wanting to have a different relationship with all of this. We knew we wanted to offer a different conversation. We had some ideas of where we might draw from, but we learned a lot just talking, bringing women together in a room and talking to them about this stuff. And that's really where Be Nourished was born. We worked in that clinic for about a year, and then it imploded. And neither clinic, one of us, the clinic imploded. The person running it was a bit of a control freak. And we didn't want to be controlled. We didn't want to be treated but like employees. And so we decided to leave and go out, get some offices together and share a tagline. And we were like, I really like this word nourish. And how about the active phrase be nourished? And that's literally how it was born.
Yeah, that's gorgeous. So how long ago was that?
It was 2006, Be Nourished was born. So Hillary and I started working together in 2005, so 12 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's fantastic. And so did you find another space to work together? Is that how you...
Yeah, so we moved our offices and we moved to a space that had a group room so we could continue to do groups together. And we were only in that space for about a year, and then we moved into our current neighborhood where we've been for the last, we've probably been there 10 years. Yeah.
And so what do you do in your offices today?
So we have a couple of practitioners that are counselors that also see clients in our space, and then we have a group space out back where we do groups and workshops and retreats and trainings for healthcare providers. Yeah.
Oh, that's gorgeous. So would you be willing, Dana, to tell us a little bit about some of the early realizations, like when you met Hillary, and you look back now and you go, oh, right, yeah, oops, or eek, you know, those moments where you're like, oh, yeah, didn't realize that.
Well, I mean, I think one of the biggest ones I've shared is, you know, when I read the book Intuitive Eating, they have a chart in that book where it shows the dieting mind, a diet. Yeah, it's like the diet mentality and a non-diet mentality.
Right.
And when I looked at these two sides, I knew that we had been promoting dieting in the research I was working, because when I looked at these two sides, I knew the majority of participants would put them in that dieting mindset.
Right.
And realizing that when our efforts to change are primarily rooted in the desire to control the size, shape, and weight of our body, it's dieting. We can call it whatever we want. So there's a lot of people doing mindful eating under the promise of weight loss or wanting to do mindful eating with the hope that it'll change the size of their body. Mm-hmm. And chances are they're still showing up with a dieting mind. And when I show my clients who believe they've given up dieting years ago, that graph, they go, oh my God, I've been dieting for all these years? So to me, that was one of the biggest ahas, was there is the presence of a dieting mind. And the more we live in a dieting culture, so most people have a dieting mind, even if they've never dieted, they have some of the qualities of a dieting mind. And if they've been chronically dieting, that mindset around food is really ingrained, and continuing to focus on weight does not help heal the dieting mind. So that was another thing, was like, we have to put thoughts about weight on the back burner. We have to reduce body checking. We stop, you know, reduce weighing and measuring and all the things we do to check our bodies to be able to shift towards healing our relationship with food and body.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Love it. Yeah. It's really interesting, because diving down into diet mind, as you call it, or diet mentality, it is really fascinating, because as you say, anything can be used by the diet mind, really, can't it? It can be, whether it is intuitive eating or mindful eating or moving the body or yoga or meditation, or there's this sense of, I think, you know, it kind of draws back to what you said originally, and that is the not good enough mind. Am I doing this good enough? Am I doing it, you know, well enough. Whereas what I know you and Hillary are really all about is coming from that place of wholeness and healing from a place of authenticity and compassion and mm-hmm. trust.
Yeah, there's a level of perfectionism and rigidity in a dieting mind, and mm-hmm. You know, in a non-dieting mind, there's much more flexibility, and the definition of what normal eating looks like is really broad, much broader than what most people would say. And
yes,
you know, we really recognize that it's not one day of eating.
Yes.
Or one eating episode, or even one week of eating, that makes a difference in our health and our well-being. It's you know, what we do consistently over time, and what are the practices that are sustainable. And so, yeah, a lot of it, you know, we tell the clients in our work, we want you to get a C in the course. We want you to go for a C in this program, and you see people's eyes just widen, like, what? And you know, Brené Brown has that quote, what we're trying to do is create a community of the adequate.
Yes.
We're going for adequacy here. C-level work. We're not interested in A students.
Yeah.
We're not interested in, it's not a requirement to get an A. If you're rooting it in perfectionism, you're rooting it in dieting.
Completely.
And so, yeah, it's a big one.
I think, would you say that that's one of the most challenging ones for people, is, you know, that sense of, okay, well, I'm not counting calories anymore. I'm not weighing myself anymore. I am letting myself have some variety or some, some flexibility. I feel like I'm, you know, on the right path. But would you say that really loosening, rather than letting go, I guess I call it loosening the grip, you know, loosening the grip on those, on the more tightly held beliefs around food, body and weight, which is all caught up in that diet mind. Do you think that's one of the hardest steps for people, is, you know, just really diving into that pool?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think there's several things that are so weird about this work versus diet culture, is, you know, there's, people are used to a quick fix. When you go on a diet, you know, within a 24-hour period of time, if you're doing it or not. You can know within 3 hours if you're on your plan and you're doing it right. And I say, I'm putting that in bunny ears.
Sure.
You know, so I think there's the rules and the rigidity, and the, you know, people are so used to handing over their power to an external source to tell them what, when, and how much to eat. And then they're used to using this rigidity and feeling like failures if they have an eating indiscretion. And we're always like, who's, according to who, was it an eating indiscretion? And they're also used to, you know, that quick fix. And this work is a long game. And I think getting used to that, people are, you know, oftentimes can feel like they're flailing in this work because they don't have that rule and those rules and that structure, which is why sometimes hunger awareness and hunger work becomes the new rule. And I think diet, you know, people can do, a few minutes ago when we were talking, I'm like, I'm pretty sure people can do intuitive eating and make it a diet.
Yes.
Because, you know, and is it really intuitive eating? Probably not, but they're doing intuitive eating with the hope that it's, you know, with the thought that if I do this right, I'm going to lose weight. And,
exactly.
And that interferes with them actually doing all the steps of becoming an intuitive eater again. So,
yeah. Oh my gosh. You raise kind of the central point, and that is, unless we're able to loosen the grip on a weight focus, it will block our path at various times.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And, we also recognize that, you know, when people live in the culture that they live in, it's really hard to have thoughts go away completely, which is why we kind of use that metaphor of the back burner, which is, you know, that you put it back there. You don't have to keep an eye, but we recognize it's going to be there. We also sometimes use the metaphor of a pop-up screen, like on your computer, like it's going to pop up and you're going to see it and you're going to go, hi. And then you're going to just minimize it and put it back down in its corner.
I love that.
Yeah, that it's not probably, you're not going to be able to click it and throw it in the garbage can, especially early in this work. I think when we get deeper into this work and we have deeper roots in it, we can do that more often than not. But, you know, it's, yeah, that idea that it's going to come up. We tell clients, you're going to, within 30 minutes of leaving our office, you're going to get a message somewhere in the culture that you're crazy for pursuing this path and you should just go back to diet culture. So there it is. Yeah. We go high and then we put it back down in the, the corner.
I love it because lots of people really like those, whether it's a visualization or storytelling or something that feels like they can really, that it doesn't have to become quote unquote a problem. You know, those thoughts or those urges don't have to become a problem, that it's something to notice. And I guess that brings us back to our mindfulness skills, doesn't it? Being able to notice something without being reactive, but being responsive and respectful to our very real experience.
Yeah, there's like a practice of non-attachment and a real, we're strengthening, you know, a muscle to witness what's happening without just automatically, habitually doing the response that we're doing. And that's, you know, when we think about this, especially in the first few weeks of any program we do, people are doing individual, they're like, and I don't even know if I'm doing it right, you know? And so, you know, one woman in a group years ago, she said, I'm noticing that I'm using the word notice a lot. Yeah, I said, you know what? I think then you're on the path and you're doing the work.
That's so great. I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
So speaking of noticing, you have both a personal yoga practice and also you have in the past been very active in teaching. So can you tell us a little bit about your yoga path, I guess, and particularly the how you have and continue to use yoga philosophy in your work?
Yeah. So when I was in grad school in the late mid-90s, I developed chronic pain and tendonitis in my arms and was seeking relief from a variety of practitioners. And one of my massage therapists who I'd been seeing for quite a while, like weekly, she kept saying to me, you know, I really think if you did yoga, a lot of this wouldn't even be here. I really think, like every week, I really think if you did yoga, this, some of the stuff would not be here. I think you'd have some of it, but it wouldn't be nearly this bad. And every week she'd say this. So finally I was like, you know what? I'm going to look into this. And I had taken a class in the early 90s when I lived in Miami and liked the yoga class. And I didn't stick with it. I was in my young 20s and just didn't, for whatever reason, didn't get super into it. Probably also for financial reasons back in those days, as I'm talking and thinking about it. But here I was in this town and I had belonged to this gym and they had a yoga class and I thought, well, why don't I go? I'll go check out the class at the gym. It's here. And I went on a Tuesday night and it happened to be a Kripalu yoga class, which I laugh in 2017
right.
to think that there's no way that you would ever find a Kripalu yoga teacher in a gym in 2017.
No.
But in 1998, 97, which is when I was doing this, yoga was not what it is today in terms of popularity in U.S. culture. You know, Madonna was just starting to practice yoga and it was getting popular. You were hearing more and more about it. So it was rising in popularity, but it certainly wasn't what it was today. So I went to this gym class, this Kripalu teacher, she used to live at Kripalu when it was an ashram. Mm-hmm. So she was the teacher and I went and I loved it. And I went back every Tuesday night for 2 years until I moved. Wow. And what I noticed is that, it became it just was easy to go. I was so drawn to go. I loved the way I felt afterwards. It was somewhat non-negotiable. It was like, this is what I'm doing on Tuesday nights. And I just always enjoyed how I felt when I left there. And also, I was starting to notice my body, my relationship with my body changed. Like I felt I had more reverence for my body. I had more appreciation for my body. And I was also really often taken by surprise that, you know, when I go into class on Tuesday nights after work, I'd be like, okay, after class, I'm going to go eat this. And then I would go to class and I would get out of class and I would be like, no, that's not what I want. I want this. And there, through the attunement process and connecting to my body, I was more in touch with what sounded good and what I actually really wanted. And I was kind of fascinated by that. And just my practice, I just started to feel like I just dropped down on the floor in my living room and started practicing on my own because it was just so tremendously healing for me. And so in 2002, I did my yoga teacher training at Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health, which is where you and I spent quite a bit of time
together, a few days. Training there.
Yeah, that's where I did my training back in 2002. Okay. It was very different back then to what it Kripalu was when you went.
I'm sure.
And so in my work with people around their relationship with food and noticing such an adversarial relationship people with their bodies, that people had in dieting culture create such an adversarial relationship with the body, where people, you know, the body is something that we do things to and on as opposed to for and with. And the body is seen as separate, and we judge it like it's this really yoga has this ability to change the relationship with the body, which tends to change, you know, maybe the desire to change comes from a deeper place where we're wanting, you know, we're just noticing that we're drawn to do different things because of how we're feeling emotionally, physically.
Yeah.
And mentally, because of the practice of yoga. So I was really interested in combining all of this in this work.
Yeah. It's such a beautiful match.
Yes. Yeah. And a lot, you know, the self-compassion, the self-acceptance, the witness, you know, we talk a lot about witness consciousness in yoga and Kripalu yoga, and developing the ability to observe non-judgmentally, which is such a huge component of mindfulness. It's not just being able to observe what's going on, but to do it in a non-judgmental way with curiosity, to look with curiosity. And I mean, even as a clinician, I think it's such a huge part of motivational interviewing. And that's another intersection. I think when I got exposed to motivational interviewing as a yoga teacher and as somebody with the kind of personality I have, I was just like, oh my gosh, yes. And there's such a curiosity, when we come to clients from a motivational interviewing perspective, that there's a real curiosity where we're asking more questions and giving less advice and listening to the person and drawing out from them versus telling them what to do and really honoring the wisdom that's already there, already alive, already present. And that is so much what yoga is about. And so, yeah, there's just all these ways, these different intersections that are really interesting to me.
Oh, absolutely. And I suppose having had that motivational interviewing background and then moving into yoga, you were much more than attuned to where those intersections lay. I can imagine your brain was probably blowing all over the place thinking, oh my goodness, this is okay, it's all kind of coming together.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It all fits very well together.
Yeah, it's beautiful. When you were talking about non-judgment, I was thinking that for a lot of people, that's one of the most tricky parts, isn't it? You know, that noticing or being curious can be tough enough for many people, but the non-judgment You know, and then noticing non-judgment can be, or noticing judgment and criticism, I should say. I find often people find that the most difficult because I suppose the neural pathways are just so deeply ingrained, and so there's having an embodied practice or having a way that we can integrate mind and body whilst noticing what's going on within us and outside of us, and noticing, you know, sensations and the movement of those sensations and the coming and the going and the just being with. I'm not sure about you, but I always just get a bit like, whoa, this is so cool. Like, this is so awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot that we can tap into. Yeah, I think I'm just noticing the presence of the inner critic and how it almost seems like human nature, and maybe it's more because of the culture we live in, but I think it's in part human nature.
Yeah.
To be, you know, that our default is to think that we can't, if we're kind to ourselves and we accept what we do, we're never going to change, you know. But I always tell my clients, if, you know, I'm pretty sure if you could have hated yourself into a version of yourself that you loved and hated yourself into having a different relationship with food than you do, you probably would have arrived a long time ago.
Totally. You know? Absolutely. Yeah.
It's like if that voice helped people change, we would live in an amazing world. I'm pretty sure of it.
I know. It would be utopian. It would be incredible.
And then I think when people really tune into that, they see how violent, you know, how violent they are, and the way they, you know, that they bully themselves, and you know, and if there's a developmental phase to the critic, it's partly we develop it to help keep us safe when we're young and we don't know to not cross the street when we shouldn't and things like that. But then it just becomes more internalized and automatic, and it starts to really, sometimes I like to talk to my clients like they have all these thoughts and they're like in their head, and there's like a board of directors up there, and and the inner critic has had the gavel and has been running the show for too long, and they need to pass the gavel to the other parts of you so that they can have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can let the critic have a seat at the table, but he doesn't get to run the show.
Oh my gosh. I've just got this visualization of like literally a board of directors. For some reason, I'm visualizing a hospital board of directors for some random reason. But I'm noticing this, you know, I'm thinking of a male, but that's my own reflection. And, you know, silence, order in the court, you will do as I demand. And everyone else kind of sitting at the table all playing nice and going along for the ride, and but giving those other people at the table, or the other characters or other parts of us, you know, some room at the table, you know, is, I would imagine that you would say that's a big part of healing.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, why it's so key for clinicians to really be thinking about how do we talk to people about their health and their behaviors and what they're doing. Because the more I read about Brené Brown's work and shame and vulnerability and how shame is poorly correlated with self-care, and it's highly correlated with addiction and depression and bullying and eating disorders and these kinds of things, the more I realize that motivational interviewing has given me a way to talk to people that keep shame out of the room. Because if we are having conversations that make people feel ashamed and feel unworthy, we're just contributing to that voice that is such a huge obstacle to change. It's not even intentional. I mean, some people love the Dr. Phil approach and think that's what people need, with just a cultural myth. But there's also just, you know, even the subtle things we say, that if we say them in a certain way, can really be a shame trigger for people. And
absolutely,
you know, there's really a language we're developing and a way of being where we're when we do this work that's it's more helpful
yes.
than harmful.
Yes. Yeah. I often, when I do some student training or training with grads, I often say, none of you are assholes. Okay. None of you, you're all very nice people. You don't come into this profession wanting to hurt or harm people. But what is really important to understand are the things that we can say and do that actually cause harm when that is not our intention, but that the impact on people doesn't necessarily, you know, it might not be something that you're aware of, you know, so
right.
Our intention is honorable and quote unquote good, you know, good intention, but the impact on people, unless you really deeply understand somebody's experience and then possibly how we can then put people right back into that shame-based experience, then we are actually colluding. And that makes people really uncomfortable. I'm like, that's why I always preface it with, I know you're not assholes. You're not. You're lovely people who deeply care, which is why this is really important to understand.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a huge one of the big teachings in social justice framework is, you know, there's intent and there's impact, and we need to be thinking about the impact we're making on people regardless of what our intention
That's right.
intention is. And I had another thought. I don't know.
You have a million brilliant thoughts, Dana. And can I just say, it was funny, when I met you last year, one thing that struck me is you have this remarkable ability to recite poetry off the top of your head, like long pieces of poetry. How do you do that? How do you do this?
I do not know. I do not know, really. But yeah, I do. I mean, one piece of it is I recite a lot of poetry in my work with clients, mm-hmm. Particularly in groups and workshops and retreats. So there's some pieces that I've read aloud so many times that they're there to some degree. I sometimes can't recite them for verbatim, but I can do a good chunk of them. So some of it's repetitive nature. Mm-hmm. I'm also a lover of quotes. Like I collect quotes. Like when I read like a book, I am underlining and starring and folding pages and pulling quotes and putting the quotes in my Facebook page. And I think there's, in part of learning how to facilitate groups and workshops, when we do readings, particularly with poetry, it taps people into a different, a more emotive place. It's a little less, intellectual. Like there's, while they're learning something, if we can get people to, you know, and always it's with the centering, we have them close their eyes and tap into their breath, and they may not close their eyes and may look softly at the floor or something, but whatever they're comfortable doing, but we center a little bit, and then I read something, and I it's through some experiential workshops at Kripalu, actually, where they've read things and they repeat certain lines, powerful lines that have tapped me into some of the most powerful healing moments. And so it's by using a lot of these readings and doing them repetitively that they will come to me in the moment. But yeah, it's a weird, I don't know exactly how there's room for all this. And I always have a book with me. You know, when I do groups and workshops, I have a book of poems and readings and excerpts from books and quotes and things that when we're on a certain topic, I'll read something and I think it brings somebody else into the room, somebody else's wisdom, and can be really powerful.
Yeah, I think so. There's something about, you know, poetry telling a story that really taps into that deep part of us. into a different part of our brain and body, and is a way to also connect with the universal experience, you know, the Me Too, that's so palpable with groups.
Yeah. Yeah. And the common humanity is such a piece, a big piece. And I think that's where the group work is so powerful. And I've been doing group work in research. I did group work, and that's where I got a lot of experience facilitating. And then have done a lot of retreats and workshops. And I think that's this work particularly is powerful when you're in community, knowing that there's other people choosing a really radical path in a culture just obsessed with the thin ideal and, you know, orthorexia and all that stuff. It's a radical path. And so to have community and to see others and to, I think to see the impacts of weight bias on people and to have a variety of shapes and sizes and colors in the room, like we start to all see it. And I think a huge path of healing, or a huge, something we talk about in groups, is how all the participants want it for everyone in that room but themselves. Like, and they kind of want it for themselves, but they're scared and they want to abide by a different set of rules, but they really believe in this and they want everyone else to do it. Something, I think, to really notice that, it puts that right front and center for people in a group setting.
Yes, I agree. And this sense of not being alone in your experience, because, you know, unfortunately, that's one of the most hurtful things about shame, is that it leads people to feel like, I'm the only one who this has happened to. I'm the only one. You know, this sense of an isolated experience, which then, you know, reduces help seeking and, prevents people from reaching out and seeking other like-minded people or health support. I'm a big fan of groups. And and I think also for us too, as providers, you know, what value have you found in having a community of providers? And I really, really want to ask about your Body Trust course as well.
Well, I think something changed. I think on the individual, when we're thinking about clients, I think there's, I think in group work, there's something about the cohesiveness and the community. And there's also, I think, more ownership in their own process. I feel like one-on-one, sometimes it's like, fix me, fix this, you know, and it's my job as the dietitian to fix this, right? There's some energy there, not always, but there's a subtleness to it. Whereas when you're in group work, I think people have a more collective sense of ownership of all of this. You know, and then certainly as a provider, when you're choosing to go against the dominant traditional weight paradigm, you're going to feel really alone and you're going to feel really weird. And and I think that's where the community is critical. And in our, you know, we have a Body Trust Provider Certification Program. That's a 6-month training intensive. And we meet for a week in Portland together. And then we have 6 months of online training, and we bring everyone together that first week with the primary goal of creating the community, a brave community, and creating a cohesiveness, and a connection so that we can continue to grow as a community together. And, I mean, there's some people doing our program that have a lot of knowledge and have been in this, doing this work for many, many years, but they come and do our training because they want the community.
Yes.
They want to be with other people.
Yeah.
And man, to think, like, as we send more and more people, we just finished our first group, and literally, like, I think the official first date of somebody to be certified was July 19th.
Oh, wow.
And so we finally have a directory on our website of Body Trust providers, and to think about people doing Body Trust groups around the world, and also having a community that's done, that's committed to this. Wants to be together and, you know, and really needs that group energy to keep going when you know, to put, you know, to choose to do this for a little while is one thing, but to stay on the path given what we face as a culture, is, it helps to know that there's others like you going forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because yeah. there's it can be very taxing, can't it? You know, it can be exhausting going into the arena, as Brené would say, again mm-hmm. and again and again. And whether that yeah. arena is your counseling space or whether it is, your, you know, working with other providers or conversations with doctors or conversations with families or with colleagues or with your own, you know, your own local community that, you know, that caring for yourself and part of caring for yourself, you know, connecting with that, with other people, other like-minded people in this space to help, refill your cup, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. To know you're not alone, to yeah. know that there's a community of people doing this.
Yes.
I mean, even when I first stopped, I kind of weaned myself off of my full-time job at this research center. It's mm-hmm. just went down to 4 days a week and then 3 days a week. And it was within a month or two of leaving or starting my business that I came across a paper. What was the paper? It was a Health at Every Size. I think it was Colorado Rockies Health at Every Size study or something.
Oh, okay.
And I read it and I thought, Health at Every Size, like what? And I'm like, oh my gosh, there's a community of people who, like, it was like, I am not making this shit up.
No, right? You are not.
Oh my God, I am not making this up. And then, you know, when you, I don't know if you've talked to Lucy Afremore yet, in your podcast, but
when she's on my hit list.
Yeah. When I came to, when I became aware of Lucy's work in critical dietetics and read one of her first published papers, I was like, who is this? Mm. And then we met at a training that her and Linda Bacon did, and I learned about her path to Hayes, and I was like, oh my gosh, we're like it's almost the exact same path. Like, she was working in the traditional weight paradigm. She thought she was helping people. She thought that, you know, and then she started to get disillusioned and wait, what are we doing? And she started to learn, you know, and she was like, we are messing people up, man.
Yes.
I am not going to do this anymore. And her work shifted, and it's just so helpful to even know that somebody's path and her path was very similar.
Yes.
To mine. Yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned before the words brave community, and I love that. Like, when you said it, I was like, oh, yes, I love it. So how would you describe what a brave community is and does?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about brave space versus safe space, and sometimes, you know, if we make space too safe, it keeps people in their comfort zones, and we know that's not where growth happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of the things I draw up on the board of any group, and often in with my individual clients, is the magic happens outside of your comfort zone, like that image of your comfort zone in one bubble and then in another bubble completely disconnected from the other one is and where the magic happens, right?
Yes.
And, you know, so brave space is different than safe space. You know, certainly we want people to know that things are going to be confidential and some of those, you know, things we do for safety. But we want people to be willing to take risks, to be vulnerable, to open, to share. And that's what comes out of a group that's agreed to create a brave space to look at our stuff, you know, like in our certification program, we tell providers this program's going to bring up your stuff, and we don't believe that you can take your clients further than you've gone in this work. Mm-hmm. And so we want to create this brave space for you to be willing to look at this and to own your story and to own where you are in the we don't expect people to be perfect. We realize that you are living in this culture just like everybody else, but that you, you know, go forth with bravery and courage to look at your stuff and to be able to say, you know, oh my gosh, I just did the body appreciation scale and oh, I'm surprised and not surprised at my score, and to really just let us hear that, you know.
Yeah.
Because when you hear that, other people step and say, I had the same experience. And that's what happens when we go towards bravery and take risks and sharing is that's where the magic happens.
Yeah.
Love Did it. I give a good, is that a good explanation? Oh,
that was beautiful. Yeah.
It felt rambly.
No, goodness. Dana, that is not a word that I would use to describe you, rambly. No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah, it's interesting. The parallel process is really interesting too, isn't it? You know, what we're asking from our clients, and then also what is required from us too. And then I guess the parallel process extends even further into the, health at every size community, you know, where we're being invited to, you know, pull up our brave pants and step into spaces that might be uncomfortable, but that's where, like you say, that's where the magic happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I just think, at a certain point in my own practice and work, I just couldn't. It's almost like I didn't have a choice, and I know I did have a choice, but yeah.
Once you know, you can't unknow. Once you see, you can't unsee, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I think it gets easier to live outside my comfort zone. You know, I think there's this place where we stretch. We're not asking people to go way outside of their comfort zone, but you know, like where are your areas to stretch? And, you know, because we tend to stay, I love Tara Moore says your inner critic is like a sleeping guard at the edge of your comfort zone.
Oh.
And when you are about to take a really critical step on your path, your critic is going to get really loud and say, who do you think you are? What do you think you're doing? There's no way, blah, blah, blah. And to know that, for me to know that, like when I jumped and left my part-time job to go fully into Be Nourished private practice, it was tremendously scary to let go of a paycheck and health insurance. You know, in this country, we're not guaranteed health insurance, and it's very expensive. You know, so to let go of those safety nets and have that, you know, to take this risk, my critic was like, oh man, you're going to be homeless. And oh man. And I was, but to know that to have that quote in my mind of Tara Morris, that your critic is like a sleeping guard at the edge of your comfort zone. And when it wakes up or when it gets loud, it means you're about to take a very important step, and it's not a sign to stop. It's not a sign it's not a stop sign. We have a card in our body trust deck that says fear is not a stop sign.
That's one of my favorites. I love that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Are they available on your website?
They, you know, we ordered them and they have disappeared. Like I think we have two left. But we are ordering more. So if you go to our website and they're not in our store, we will have more. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. No, that's amazing, because I love your cards. I think they're absolutely gorgeous. And there's a lot of you and Hillary in those cards too. You can see, you know, a lot of the work and a lot of the passion that you have for communities in those cards. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a beautiful reminder for both for people in our community and providers as well, just to kind of come back to our center and remind ourselves why we're doing this, because it's for the collective consciousness.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. They were super fun to make.
And I bet. Yeah.
And to brainstorm and
I'm sure you had like 200 you had to shortlist.
Oh, we did. Yeah, we had to put several on the back. So we've got our read
deck. Second deck.
But someday will be the second deck. Exactly.
Absolutely. So for Be Nourished, for you and Hillary, what I've I've noticed over the years is that there's been a stronger and stronger undercurrent of social justice work that you've both been involved in. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, social justice and body healing and you know, how that's come to play a much more dominant role in your practice?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think where it started was when we went up to Seattle to Linda and Lucy's, I think it was called Passing on the Haze Message or something. Mm-hmm. And we went up to Seattle and spent a week with them. And there was one full day that they spent on social justice mm-hmm. stuff. And I remember looking over at Hillary. We were about halfway through the day, and then we were probably on day four. So we'd been there a whole week, lots of stuff. And then on day four, we get all the social justice perspective. And I remember looking at Hillary, and she was welled up in tears. And I thought, what's going on? And her father had passed away a couple months prior to that. So I thought, oh, I think she's, you know, and I said, are you okay? And she goes, I can't take it. This is horrible. This is just like, it was just to hear the data. And it, she just was very touched by it. We both were, but particularly she was just welled up in tears. And so I really believe that that's kind of when we started to see this, our work through that lens and have learned more about social justice in general. And, you know, the big piece of it to me is how all oppression is connected.
Yeah.
And we're not all free until we're all free. Mm-hmm. And that there's all these intersecting identities that we're working with. So we want to be mindful of, you know, one thing we in recent years, like the transgender community and body, how do we have, you know, consider the transgender community and body acceptance and body trust when there's some things within the gender dysphoria that are, you're going to bump up against some stuff when we talk about body image and body trust when somebody is has gender dysphoria and is transgender. And so, you know, to me, there's a humility and we seek to be humble in this and to know that there's a lot more to know than there is that we already know. Like, we have a lot to learn. And to really recognize our privilege, you know, that living in a thin, white, cis women, who are pretty average sized bodies, you know, we pass in the community that we've been offered a lot of privilege that people, you know, and people of color don't have that privilege. People in fat bodies don't have that privilege. So to really start to look at things through a lens of privilege, even in our, you know, dietary recommendations are so often rooted in classism and, and so, yeah. So it's really widened the lens, and I think we're still learning a lot. But it's certainly given us a much wider lens to look at all this through. And, you know, things, I think that's probably what's changed our work the most in the last few years, especially. I can't remember what year we did that training with them, but
Yeah, that was just before Linda came out to Australia. So that would have been 4 years ago, maybe?
Yeah.
About 4 years ago?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah,
and we're still doing that. We have these post-its that we just reordered, and we chose some new phrases because, you know, we've learned that some of the phrases we had in our first post-its, they're kind of based off of Operation Beautiful, where they have phrases like you're already beautiful, and some of them for people with disabilities or transgender, when you say there's nothing wrong with your body, that is not inclusive. And that is not body positive. And so we just discontinued that card and ordered new phrases for our thing because there were a few that from our learning in these last few years, we're like, we can't put this on a post-it anymore.
Yeah. The evolution of understanding bodies is so interesting. Yeah. And like you, I feel that that my understanding over the past couple of years in particular is like, oh, okay. And thank goodness for this beautiful community of people who have really helped us understand. I'm not sure about you, but I haven't ever felt really criticized. Kind of felt like, okay, so when you say that, this is what you're missing, or this is the nuance of this that you're not quite getting, or you know, how might this appear in somebody who doesn't relate to the gender, you know, with which they were assigned at birth? You know, how could this be, you know, perhaps unhelpful for them? So it's I found a lot of kindness and generosity in the Health at Every Size and wider community to help us understand privilege, oppression, and language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the language is a key. And I think, I mean, to be engaged in bravery means being willing, to take the risks and make mistakes and fumble over your words and stumble over your words and to circle back around. I mean, I think that's a big part of the bravery is that when we make mistakes and we blow it and we're going to blow it. Yeah. We don't hide and armor up with perfectionism. We know we're going to blow it, that we hear the feedback, we circle back around, we do what we can to shift and change.
Yeah. Do you know what, Dana? It would be so wonderful if there was, and I don't actually know whether this exists in the US. It may. I'm running with assumptions here. We need a social justice unit, don't we, in dietetics? Where, you know.
Yeah. The more and more, you know, we talk about our work, the more we describe it as really helping people, including clinicians,
yes,
develop the resiliency needed to live in a world filled with weight bias, to compassionately live in a world filled with weight bias. I feel like that more and more is what we're doing. And that, to me, has such a strong social justice you know, it just really shows how, you know, you would ask me to describe our work even, you know, 5-6 years ago, that is not this, that statement did not exist for me. So yeah, I think there's a willingness to put stuff out there and to know that it's going to morph and change over time. And that's a good thing. That's how we grow. That's how we learn. Yes. That's how we're honing. Right. And then there's, you know, with, especially around bodies and size, I think sizeism is often left out of the discourse and social justice where trainings we've gone to on social justice haven't even talked about weightism and sizeism. Mm. And even healthism, you know? So it's interesting to be in this, particularly engaged in this part of social justice work, because there's a lot of people who believe in social justice that don't realize the amount of weight bias they've internalized. Dang. And how, you know, how much of it is rooted in bullshit. They really look at the research, right? Like they think they're, I care about people and just I'm trying to be healthy. And
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, P.S. you care about certain people.
Yeah. And so that's interesting too, to be, you know, taking that charge, and particularly in the realm of health is, I just don't think, in size, I just don't think that, so it seems like a lot of the people in our trainings and workshops, when they go and other social justice things, they're like raising their hands. So what I'm curious, what about weight? You know, and they're constantly putting on the radar of people who have worked in social justice, the social justice field for years, but sizeism isn't really on the radar.
Yeah. Do you think that, I mean, given the, especially the current climate in the US, do you think that it's been, more race has kind of come front and center, which has pushed some other things further back?
Possibly. I think it's I've been reading some Audre Lorde stuff, and this year one of the thing commitments I made to deepen my understanding of social justice work is to commit to reading only books of people of color.
Right, yeah.
And written by people with marginalized identities. And when I read these things, one thing that blows me away is how long people have been talking about this stuff.
Yeah.
And I am just a white woman waking up, you know? And I read Audre Lorde's stuff and I look at the dates of her essays and I'm like, 1970, oh my God, facepalm.
I wasn't even born.
Yeah, and I have this paper open on my desktop. What is it? It's was written in 1990 and it's disordered eating in women of color. When are we gonna start to see eating disorders as things that impact more than thin white women?
Absolutely. From
you know, affluent communities. Mm-hmm. And this was written in 1990. Mm. Face plant. I feel like you know, there's just so much work to do and there's people that have been doing this work for so long. And I think as long as we, you know, keep an intersectional lens and continue to have this idea that all oppression is connected.
Yeah.
And that, you know, when there's that quote, like, if you've come to free me, you know, forget it. But if you've come because your liberation is bound up within mine, then let us work together. I didn't say that verbatim, but that is like my liberation is bound up in the Black Lives Matter movement,
sure, yeah.
The trans movement. We cannot all be free until we're all free. And so, you know, whether people are talking about race or they're talking about other, like, to me, they're all connected and it's all moving towards healing and living in a better world.
Yeah. And you and Hillary are just, and others, you know, because I'm sure it probably makes you uncomfortable just to hear about you and Hillary, you and Hillary, you and Hillary. There are a lot of other people I know that support you, including your loved ones and the communities in which you move. But I guess from me, just wanted to extend just such enormous gratitude to you and to Be Nourished and to everything that you are. You're everything you're doing and saying and being, because without you being in that brave space, you know, it doesn't invite other people to be in brave space, and then you're in brave space by yourselves. Mm. So I just wanted to extend enormous, enormous thanks for your leadership.
Thank you. And you're welcome. Thank you. And you're welcome. Yeah. Something I'm working in therapy is like receiving. Like, okay, you can receive that. You're welcome, Fiona. Thank you for saying that. You're welcome. Instead of like, let's not go there.
Right. Which is why I ran with the, I don't know whether it'll be, whether you would like to have received that as thank you and Hillary, as if you're the only two people doing this work. Because I know that you would then be extending that beyond yourselves to the people that have been teachers for you through your lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we wouldn't be here without the people we've learned so much from, and,
right.
You know, all the people who've come before us, and, you know, some of our trainees, they look at this fat underground stuff that's been out since the 70s and they're just like, what? What?
So, I know.
Yeah, they've laid the groundwork and,
absolutely.
You know, I think, you know, we've been working on language, and for whatever reason, we're in this space, in this position. But yeah, we know that there's been a lot of people for a really long time working to make it possible that we can even do this work in the world.
Right. So,
and have right. people signing up for our programs and stuff. But
So just to circle back around to your program. So how can people find you and your programs? Because Body Trust, I mean, seriously, if I didn't live literally on the other side of the world, I would absolutely be in your cohort. And I've just heard such amazing things about the Body Trust program, or the it's not called a program. What's it called? Body Trust.
The certification program? Yeah, the certification training. Yeah, so you can find us at benourished.org. That's the active phrase, benourished.org. We also are on Facebook and have an Instagram and Twitter accounts, so you can find us on social media. We do offerings for both the general public and providers. Particularly our registered trademark is Body Trust. We trademarked it a couple of years ago.
Thank you to
just kind of put everything under that umbrella. So we offer workshops, retreats, online programs for people wanting to move towards body trust in their personal life. And then we are training healthcare providers in how to do this kind of work, because that's the one thing that seems to be lacking in this community is the training. You know, we've learned from other people, and there's not a formal training in this.
No,
that's in our opinions, particularly long enough and extensive enough for people to really get the nuances of this work. So, and the support and transformation doesn't happen in the head. It's, you know, if there's a process of learning that we can know all this stuff, but there's something different when we come together and talk about it. So we have a 30-day e-course called Promoting Body Trust in Clinical Practice. That's an evergreen course, which means it starts the day that you purchase it and it drips into your email box. And it's a great way to learn more about this approach and a little bit more about Be Nourished. And if you're at all interested in the certification program, which is a 6-month program, the e-course is a great way to get to know us and see if you feel drawn to work with us. And it's also a prerequisite of the program, because we want people to really know what they're getting into before signing up for a 6-month program. And that is an interdisciplinary training program. I mean, we have dietitians and coaches and therapists and physicians, and we have people from a variety of places around the world participating. And when you're done at the end of the 6 months, you get to call yourself a certified body trust provider and be in our directory and be in our community. And again, I think there's a lot of people in our community that are have a fair amount of knowledge with this work and want to know more and go deeper and want the community. So those are the resources we have for people. We also do some retreats for clinicians as well. The one you came to, Embodied Practitioner at Kripalu.
Oh my gosh. So that's in November, isn't it, at Kripalu?
Yeah, I think it's November 5th through the 8th at Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health in Lenox, Massachusetts. After the BETA conference.
Yeah, so I will see you there. Now, both you and Hillary are presenting separately, I think, at BETA. Is that right? Or together?
We're presenting separately at the Renfrew conference.
Ah, right. Yes, that's right.
But at BETA, we're presenting on healthism at the conference, and then we have a pre-conference workshop as well.
That's right.
On strategies to love your work more than ever. So lots of opportunities to work with us, whether you're looking to do this work personally or professionally. Our website has all of it on there.
Yeah, absolutely. You're going to be busy ladies, aren't you, in November?
Yeah, the fall is always busy. And we're there for like 10 days on the East Coast.
Wow, yeah.
Nice. And then Kripalu, and then Renfrew.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Now you're tempting me to call my travel agent and say, excuse me, change my flights. That's it. I'm staying.
Yeah, we'd love to have you.
It was so amazing. Yeah, so I can thoroughly, thoroughly recommend any training that you do with Dana and Hillary and Be Nourished. 100% behind the work that you do. It's really incredible, and it's really life-changing, to be honest. 100% would support anybody looking into this kind of work more, for sure.
Thank you, Fiona. It's been great to talk with you today.
And you too. What an absolute pleasure. And I look forward to seeing you again in November.
Yes.
Great.
Sounds good.
Thanks so much, Dana. Bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Well, that's our episode of the Mindful Dietitian interview series for today. Thank you so much to our wonderful guest and to you for listening. I really hope you enjoyed it. Just a reminder that you can find me over on the website www.themindfuldietitian.com.au, and please join actually quite a large group of wonderful and enthusiastic dietitians on the closed Facebook group, The Mindful Dietitian. The music you hear is called Happiness from Ben Sound, used under the Creative Commons license. Have a great day, everyone.